This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Every program on NPR, including this one, has long solicited comments and criticism from listeners, but over time, the volume of this correspondence increased dramatically beyond what the staffs of individual programs could address. Also, some listeners felt NPR did not respond to their concerns. So the network followed the example of some other news organizations and appointed an ombudsman, an independent listener's advocate, who weighs in on everything from questionable grammar to editorial bias. Jeffrey Dvorkin, a former executive here at NPR and before that at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, is that advocate. He also writes a weekly column on our webpage, www.npr.org. But today he takes his act on the air. Later on in the program, we'll bring you excerpts from President Bush's speech on democracy in the Middle East, and we'll talk about the effect of today's huge pro-Syrian demonstration in Beirut with somebody who was there. But first, we want to hear from you. If you have questions about NPR's coverage, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR Ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin. And it's nice to have you back on the program.
Nice to be with you, Neil.
When you were with us earlier, you were talking with one of your colleagues from another new organization about the idea of the ombudsman and what it can do. This is the first time we've asked you on specifically to answer questions about NPR coverage from listeners. How much correspondence do you get every day?
Well, last year was a banner year for listener emails. My assistant and I processed over 80,000, and that was just about NPR alone and a few about public radio stations, which I forwarded to them. It was a banner year because of a couple of things. One, the election, primarily. But also because of Bob Edwards leaving NPR, and that was a huge issue for many listeners, and they wanted to know why, and they still feel, in many ways, they haven't had a straight answer.
And what do you do with an email complaint saying something like, you know, the reporter got the fact wrong?
Well, in a way, that's an easy one to do because it's quite specific, and you can go. I do go directly to the editor, to the reporter, him or herself, and get a response. And that's fairly easy to correct. There's a level above that that requires more investigation and maybe an on-air correction by the program, and certainly to post the correction on the website. And then there's the highest form where people feel that they have been severely abused by the news organization, and that takes further inquiry and perhaps more involvement with other levels of management.
Well, we'll get to those in a minute, but there was an example you cited in one of your columns on your webpage, on our webpage, of a reporter who said next month's Palestinian elections, and it turned out that report was broadcast in January. It was that month's Palestinian.
Right.
And so this was an example. I think you looked into it and found the piece had actually been filed earlier and just held on to too long, and nobody got around to correcting that.
Right. And one of the things that occurred to me was that I wondered if the story had become so kind of caustic in a way for many journalists that they weren't paying enough attention to it in the way that they once did. The story of the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, although it's quieter now and my email flow has diminished from the darker days of the Intifada, it's still a story that has worn badly on a lot of newsrooms. And in speaking with fellow ombuds, both in the United States and abroad, there's a real battle fatigue among journalists about this story, because listeners on both sides of the issue pay so much attention to it and have such a depth of knowledge and a depth of passion and emotion on it that it is kind of wearing. And I sense that a lot of journalistic organizations are saying, you know, we've really had enough of this story.
Just getting back to that specific case, if you detect a mistake, or even if you don't, I mean, do you respond to that individual emailer to say, yes, you were right, there was a mistake made, here's why it happened?
I think on a simple matter like that, it's easy to do, and I don't want to get in the way of the business of getting a program on the air. If I can sort that out quickly, I can. For something a little more substantial, I go to the journalist directly and ask for his or her response to the listener's complaint if I deem it to be a worthy issue. And I expect the journalist to respond in a timely manner to me, which is 2 or 3 days, mm-hmm. I would say. And if the answer is still unsatisfactory to the listener, then I will do an investigation. And the results of that investigation go to the listener, go to the journalist, and go to management.
And in all of this, your independence is the critical factor, isn't it?
I think it's the most important factor, because when I started this 5 long years ago, I thought in order for this position to have any credibility and any authority, I had to prove to you, the ink-stained wretches inside NPR, as well as to the listeners, as well as to management, that I was...
An example of print bias, listeners.
Exactly. We're starting to show our age, aren't we? But I think that I had to show that I was an equal opportunity shin kicker, mm-hmm. By going after some management decisions, some journalistic screw-ups, and occasionally when the listener may be absolutely outraged but have it wrong.
Let's get some listeners on the air. That's what you're here to do. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Jerry, who's calling from Pikesville, Maryland.
Hi.
Hi.
I hope you do explain why Bob Edwards is no longer a dominant figure on NPR. But here's my question. And I think you have fallen into a trap on a couple of occasions, and I'll give an example if you want me to. And that is the moral equivalence thing. Someone makes an argument that has the semblance of truth, and it may be close to absolute truth, and someone makes a contrary argument that is totally devoid of facts. I think you and a lot of news organizations are giving equal time or almost equal time to something that's factually wrong. What about that equivalency argument that I think is destroying a good deal of important news coverage? I'd like to hear you address that.
Well, I think Jerry's has a really important point, that sometimes just saying here's left, here's right, we'll let you decide is a kind of an abandonment of our journalistic responsibility, which I think ultimately is to find out what the truth of the matter is. And at a time when we are, many news organizations are overwhelmed with information and with competing claims, it's easier, frankly, to say, here's the left, here's the right, you decide. And I think that that's not good journalism. Unfortunately, it's increasingly prominent in many journalistic organizations and occasionally on NPR as well.
Well, Jerry's point, in which you responded, is that sometimes there's only one side, but sometimes there are more than two.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's the ability to delve into the nuance that makes good journalism so valuable. And I think that that's something that when NPR does it, and it does it quite frequently, I have to say, it is a real value to society.
Neil?
Yes, Jerry.
Can I just supplement this? I'll give you an example that bothers me as a retired military person. The Swift Boat Veterans thing, I don't think any news organization properly handled it. It was viewed as a moral equivalency problem when it shouldn't have been, when you ended up with the guy who was in peril in Vietnam getting bad coverage, while the guy who escaped into a Texas National Guard unit that was never going to be mobilized for Vietnam getting the upside. And when the drama is resolved in favor of the people who are exploiting lies, it seems to me that's a bad result. And if you have any comment, I'd love to hear them. Thank you.
Oh, Jerry, thanks for the call.
Well, I think that the other aspect of that story was that it happened in the middle of an election campaign. And the pressure on news organizations to be equivalent at a time like that was huge, as you'll recall, Neil.
Some recollection,
yeah.
Of this, yes.
And I think that that was a complicating factor. To do that story properly required perhaps more attention and resources that were available to news organizations than they could. CBS fell into a very difficult situation because their competitive edge was at stake and they wanted to get a story on the air during an election campaign, and the high standards that CBS practiced and claimed to have were abandoned, it seems to me, in that rush to get some, that rush to publish, rush to get on the air.
Let's get another caller on. This is Zahid. Zahid's calling from Virginia Beach.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Neil, I have personally written to you about the this in the subcontinent Kashmiri dispute between India and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Your program, Neil, you yourself or your program, Talk of the Nation, I have yet to see our coverage of 1 hour on this program. Here and there, you know, when Musharraf is visiting, you have some coverage of this issue, which is a very global issue. It's a two sort of, you know, nuclear power, you know, missile facing at each other.
Global flashpoint.
Exactly, which President Clinton said, you know, while he was a president, it's a nuclear flashpoint. Yet you personally, I don't think that, I know that you have an interest, but I see very, very severe lack of coverage on this issue by you, especially TOTN.
Well, thank you for your comment, and we have done some, and obviously, in your opinion, not enough, and maybe not enough. It's a difficult issue to do for a talk show because it's hard to get calls from people on either side in Kashmir. It's also very emotional for those few who do call. Jeffrey, in a way, Zahid is talking about sins of omission as well as our sins of commission that you hear about.
Right, and I do get a lot of suggestions for stories and topics, which I forward on to the editors, and many of these stories, even on Talk of the Nation, when
mm-hmm.
your producer is very amenable to a good program idea, and I'm happy to forward them along.
When we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your questions with the one man at NPR who always gets more mail than I do, our ombudsman. What are your concerns about NPR's programming? Our news oversight in general, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with NPR Ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin and taking your questions and thoughts about what NPR gets right and what it doesn't. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. And Mark is with us. Mark's calling from Wheaton, Illinois.
Yeah, just had a question. What Jeffrey's relationship is like with the reporters when they see him walking the hall, do they run the other direction, or are they happy to have the opportunity to kind of explain what their stories are about?
If I understood that correctly, it's do reporters flee at the sight of me stalking the halls? Actually, the reception's been incredibly good. I mean, I have some interesting arguments and discussions. There are a couple of editors who won't talk to me, which is their absolute right, as they see fit. But overall, it's been extremely positive. I think people at NPR understand that the value of accountability and transparency is good for credibility, good for their credibility, and good for their journalism. So I try to get out of my office. It's a bit of an isolating job, and so I do stroll around the property a couple of times a day just to schmooze and to exchange ideas and to, frankly, to pick up information about what they're hearing too.
Great, thanks.
Okay, Mark. Just out of curiosity, as I mentioned earlier, you worked for a long time at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Indeed.
Was there an ombudsman there? Is there now?
Yes, there was, and there still is. A colleague of mine, David Bazet, who I worked with in the early days in Montreal, is now the ombudsman at the network in Toronto. And the ombudsman there is, I think, a little bit different than it is at NPR. David sees the role more at a certain remove from the public, that he doesn't I think I'm quoting him accurately, where he says that he doesn't feel that he needs to get out and explain journalistic ethics or how the CBC has dealt with it. He will investigate and write a report for management and post those reports on the CBC website. But I've always thought that this is a job where it's a bit of a bully pulpit for journalism, and I'm happy to talk on the radio and meet the folks. And I do. Last year, I think I met with 82 separate groups, both here in Washington and around the country, so which I enjoy doing a lot.
Let's talk next with Anthony, calling from Clinton, Connecticut.
Yes, two comments, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mr. Dvorkin has an incredibly challenging job, and I think he does it very well. I had a job a couple of years ago where I was required to watch TV news for 12 hours a day.
You poor man.
It's yeah. called minimum security prison, isn't it?
close. 8 days out of every 12, I spent 12 hours a day watching TV news. And I must say, in the 18 months since that job ended, I haven't watched more than 15 minutes of TV news, but I have been listening to NPR and haven't turned off the radio yet. So you must be doing something right. A segue, one of the people I had to watch occasionally was Bill O'Reilly. And I do have to take issue with apparently Mr. Dvorkin's response to Terry Gross on that particular issue. I thought, Bill O'Reilly is a browbeater and a pit bull. And I thought that her interview of him was quite measured from the excerpts I've heard of it. I unfortunately didn't hear the entire interview.
Just to remind listeners that Bill O'Reilly appeared on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, which is distributed by NPR News, produced at WHYY in Philadelphia. It was an aggressive interview. Mr. O'Reilly took exception and left.
Yes, he left 2 minutes before the end. Dick Cavett once mentioned that he did a 90-minute interview with someone who stomped out in a huff 30 seconds before the show was over, thus guaranteeing more publicity. And I agree that Bill O'Reilly is a bully and has a rather aggressive persona on his program. My problem with the way that Terry interviewed him, and I heard this from NPR listeners, I could tell the difference between the O'Reilly acolytes and the public radio listeners.
Good.
And I got enough emails from public radio listeners for me to have another listen to it again. And I thought that in terms of NPR's own standards of fairness, that in this instance, and I have a great deal of respect for Terry, I think she's a fabulous interviewer, but I think in this case, she let ideology get in the way of good journalism, and she went after O'Reilly in an unfair way, in an ideological way. The thing that did it for me as well was at the end, once he had walked off, she continued to read a criticism of him, and he was not in the studio to defend himself. It's entirely his choice whether he wants to stay or not, but to continue to attack or pretend to continue to interview someone who isn't there is unethical, and it's called the empty chair interview, and we don't do that in NPR.
I really appreciate that, and I appreciate the fact that that NPR has higher standards than Bill O'Reilly does.
Well, frankly, some days that isn't too hard.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Anthony.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Todd. Todd's in St. Louis.
Hi, Neil. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I just want to mentioned I'd written in to the ombudsman because I'd heard it part of the, recap of after Arafat's death, and one of the reporters mentioned that the entire Israeli Olympic team had died. And since I'd known that they were actually shot and murdered, I was wondering if saying they had died violates some sort of standard, or perhaps there was a better way to say it to be more accurate. And what the ombudsman thought of that.
Right. Well, I didn't hear that report, but I think you're referring to the murder of the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics in 1972. If a reporter had referred to the Israeli athletes having died, it does make it sound a little more non-judgmental than the facts exist. And I agree with you that the word murdered or killed should have been used. Language is always extremely problematic in everything we do. It's not problematic. It's a necessity that we use language that's accurate and to the point. But there are some journalistic stories where the language becomes almost a weapon in for one side or the other. And the Middle East is certainly a prime example of that. There's not a lot of neutrality in any of the language. Is it are they disputed territories? Are they occupied territories? Are they targeted killings? Are they assassinations? Is it terrorism? Are they militants, et cetera, et cetera? And I think NPR has tried pretty hard to find a neutral way to describe these things. I don't think NPR has been as successful as it might. Last Sunday in the New York Times, my colleague Dan Okrent wrote about the squeamishness of news organizations to use the T word, terror and terrorism, when describing attacks on civilians. And I think that NPR in the past has not has backed away from that word. And I sense recently that the word is more applicable and used more frequently now.
Todd, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk with Paul, and Paul's calling us from Toledo, Ohio.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just a quick question. I'm wondering if NPR is generally recognized or perceived as the more liberal of the radio organizations, and I'm wondering if you find in the letters and the phone calls that you receive that NPR is generally preaching to the choir, or if there's a more mixed-based audience, if maybe you're getting some of those O'Reilly viewers that listen to NPR and actually try to get a more balanced viewpoint. I'll just take your answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Paul.
Well, this is a really interesting and an important issue. For one thing, so much of journalism is about opinion these days. I think that NPR's journalism is about fact-based reporting and some opinion and some commentary and some analysis. It's a kind of an attempt to be a measured balance of those aspects. But as David Weston, writing in the Columbia Journalism Review this month, said that, you know, when all you have is opinion, everything else seems like another opinion. NPR comes under attack quite frequently for its apparent left-wing bias. But most of these criticisms come from media organizations that are openly conservative. So I take those kinds of criticisms with a certain amount of salt. I do think that NPR has tried very hard in the last few years to be broader in its approach so that there are more conservatives and conservative opinions heard on the radio on NPR than there used to be. And that is a shock to the system for some listeners who are used to hearing a certain kind of radio. I don't think that NPR's job is to provide informational comfort food to anyone. I think our job is to provide a range of opinions so people can make up their own minds. Is there a imply, is there a kind of left-wing bias to NPR specifically or to the media in general? And I think one of the best conclusions of that is came from the Columbia Journalism Review, which kind of looked overall at the media landscape in America and said, for the most part, the owners are conservative. There is some kind of liberal empathy in the part of some journalists because their curiosity about how other people live tends to involve a certain liberal stance. I think one way of describing it is that, and I have no hard evidence for this, so this is purely an impression that I have, is that journalists may be a little bit to the left on social issues and a little bit to the right on economic issues, probably a lot like many people in the United States.
Can you characterize the ideology of the volume of complaints that you get? Are they mostly from the left, mostly from the right?
They are mostly from the left, accusing NPR of going to the right. And I think the fact that there are more conservative voices on the air than before is, a shock to the system. I think that NPR's acceptance of underwriting from sources such as Walmart has caused a lot of listeners to raise eyebrows quite high into their foreheads. Because for many public radio listeners, Walmart's business practices are antithetical to them. That hasn't stopped NPR from reporting on Walmart. At last count, NPR has done 7 stories on Walmart and the difficulties that it's having in establishing itself in various locations, protests against them, protests against their business practices.
Let's get another caller on the air, and this is Joe. Joe's calling from St. Louis.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Two real quick questions. Number one, before you hang up, could you please spell Jeffrey's last name? And the second question is, I'm a retired psychologist here in St. Louis, and I did federal and state programs for quite a few years, but I find no programs about non-religious programming on NPR where our point of view or the range of our opinions be negotiated. I hear a new program for morals and ethics on the program by some young lady, and I hear lots of religious people, Jewish, all kinds of different Catholic, Protestants, all of them, get on the air. And my question to Jeffrey is, why isn't that programming done? Because there's a huge amount of real quiet people like myself who don't join organizations but do have a clear idea of what they feel.
Let me help you out on the spelling. D-V-O-R-K-I-N, and Jeffrey, I know you get a lot of complaints about grammar. Thank heaven spelling is really not important in public radio because you'd be overwhelmed. But to get on to the gist of Joe's comment.
Good.
Right, and I'm thinking of changing my name to...
Smith?
No, Spike Dvorkin, I think. I think that there are... Religion is playing a huge role in American life now, more than before. Certainly this administration sees faith-based initiatives as something that the president is very interested in promoting. There's the power of evangelical Christianity in this country that is manifesting itself in very deliberate political ways. I do get emails from people saying, you know, I've heard enough about religion, and I would like to hear more about the role of secularism in American life. And I think that this is something that Barbara Bradley Haggerty, who is our religion correspondent, and occasionally will venture to become our non-religion correspondent, will do stories on this. And she and I actually talked about this on Sunday when we were speaking at a church together about the coverage of religion and why it seems so much more prominent now and how people respond to that. So, Joe, your question is really timely, and I'll make sure that Barbara is aware of it as well.
Thank you ever so much.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Sure. We're talking with Jeffrey Dvorkin, NPR's ombudsman, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Kathleen is our next caller, calling from Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Has NPR ever hired an independent and qualified organization to verify or measure NPR's coverage on the Middle East as far as language use and time given to all sides?
Yes, there's a quarterly report done by an outside academic whose name escapes me for the moment, but it's on the website. I've done a couple of studies as well, and my conclusion back in the during the Intifada, I think I did this in 2002, was that I found looking at language, looking at whether it was demonstrably biased in one way or another, I found that 72% of all the stories were in and of themselves balanced, and that the language used was neutral. Of the remaining 28%, two-thirds of them were uniquely used language that could be interpreted as being pro-Palestinian and a third pro-Israel. And I felt that at that point, the coverage, because it was so... aggravating, frankly, to so many people, that we needed to do a better job in making sure that the language wasn't an impediment to the understanding of the conflict. And in many instances, the use of language or the use of audio in that story was a way in which people could dismiss NPR's coverage. It wasn't allowing people to listen all the way through. And I think one of the problems that I sensed at that point was that the writing for the ear, the writing for radio, needed to be strengthened in order to tell that story better.
And if one wants to find out the results of the outside organization, what is the name of that study?
It's on the website, on the NPR website, npr.org, and click on the lower right-hand side where it says Middle East.
Okay.
You'll find it there.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
And a quick question, Mary from Manistee, am I pronouncing that right?
Manistee.
Manistee, Michigan. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question and a subject. The question is, if I send in a handwritten letter, will anybody read it?
Yes, I'll read it. I get it. It's true that most of the letters I get are on email, but I do get written mail as well.
And my subject is the billion-ton gorilla under the carpet, the upward transference of wealth, how it happens.
Good story idea. I'll happily pass that along.
And perhaps, has your pension fund been plundered this week?
I'll have a look when I get home.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye.
We're going to take a short break and finish up our conversation with Jeffrey Dvorkin when we return, and then hear two voices on Lebanon's push for independence from Syria, one of them President Bush's. We'll be right back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In just a few minutes, we'll look into the most recent developments in Lebanon. President Bush gave a speech today and again demanded Syria withdraw from Lebanon before elections, which are scheduled to be held there in May. 500,000 people gathered in Beirut today to show their support for Syria and for Hezbollah. Right now, we're finishing up our conversation with NPR Ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin, who's with us here in the studio. 800-989-8255, if you'd like to join us, totn@npr.org. And Rick has been very patient. Rick's on the line from Gays Mills, Wisconsin.
Hi, Mr. Dvorkin. I'm asking you for some advice on how to handle an issue that I hear coming up on both NPR National from both correspondents and often guests and local stations, and has to do with gay folks. They constantly say that gay is a lifestyle you pick, which is so untrue. Our sexuality is just part of us. And I would compare it against recent commentary where a famous university professor remarked that perhaps there's something inferior about women, or you would not permit such remarks to be made. And I'm concerned about that misinformation that's constantly perpetuated.
Right. I think that I don't think that NPR reporters have said that that being gay is a choice. But there are certainly people who think this is so. I think this is a huge issue in America now, and there's a lot of debate and emotion and perhaps a lot of heat and not a lot of light around it. I think that this is something that NPR is committed to covering without necessarily being an advocate for one side or the other. But there are certainly aspects of the issue around gay marriage, for example, that draw parallels that NPR has reported on to the civil rights movement of a generation ago. And I think that these are important stories to report on and to continue to report on.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that you about gay marriage. I was just suggesting about gay people, period, regardless of anything else, that sexuality is just innate in people. And I would look to NPR to clarify the realities of just being human.
Sure. I think that's an excellent point. I couldn't agree more.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Let's go to John. John's with us from San Diego.
Hi.
Hi.
First thing I'd like to mention is that NPR does do a great job of being fair and balanced, unlike others who claim to be. But I do have a comment about media in general, and NPR has also been guilty of this, which has been focusing a lot of negative stories, even if they're not of the scale that some positive stories may be. And I have two examples I'd like to mention. One was right after 9/11. I was reading some foreign newspapers, and in Karachi, Pakistan, there was a huge peace vigil where they had candlelight to show their support for the victims, and I didn't see it on the media anywhere. But even if a few thousand people get together and do some kind of violent, you know, anti-U.S. protest, we see it all over the media.
I think that's a good point, and that a lot of what passes for journalism is about conflict. The conflict may or may not be important, but the conflict becomes an essential element of the story because it gives a kind of creative tension to the reporting of it. And I think that you make a very good point that sometimes stories are important without that sense of conflict, because they mark an evolution in the development of a story or a consciousness in how that story is being told. So I think that's a really important point.
Right, my second example I'd like to share was recently, as we know, there was a Christian Arab family that was massacred here in the U.S. And immediately after the murder, people blamed Muslims and Islamic extremists and this. And it was all over the media that this was who they suspected without any proof that did it. Recently, an arrest was made of two Christians for the murder, and we have not heard anything about clarifying that this was not done by Muslims, even though they got blamed for it. Anyway, the bad media went out, just like in the Oklahoma bombing. There seems to be a quick judgment and a negative image thrown around without proof, and when something contrary comes up, things aren't cleared up enough.
Right. I may have missed that. I don't think NPR has done that story.
I don't recall, but I don't listen to as much NPR as you do, Jeff.
But I know that story has had a lot of prominence because the assumption was that it was a hate crime, and it turns out not to have been a hate crime. These were Coptic Christians in New Jersey who were killed.
Yes. Thank you very much. And again, you do the best job anywhere out there.
Well, thank you very much, John. We appreciate that. Here's an email question from Richard Danka in Newton, Massachusetts. My question, why doesn't NPR give the Ombudsman a regularly scheduled appearance on any of its programs, in fact, not require such an appearance, perhaps go to a different program each time? It's simply not enough to have the Ombudsman's reports available only on the NPR website. Well, in this instance, I'm going to make the presumption to answer for Jeffrey, who is going to be a regular here on Talk of the Nation, particularly, I think, Jeffrey, because of the availability to interact with listeners that we have uniquely on this program.
Yeah, I'm delighted to do it. I think this is a great opportunity, and I'm happy to have this chance.
I'm not going to let you go, though, before I ask you to address an issue that you raised in the column on your website that you posted today, and that's about the level of anger in the country and how that is transmitting itself via email.
Well, the column, which I think may be up now or certainly will be up by the end of business today, is about email etiquette. And it occurred to me in discussions with I was talking to Michael Gettler from The Washington Post yesterday, and we're both noticing a rising tide of incredibly abusive emails. I have to say most of the emails I get are not, but I am noticing that they are getting crankier. And one of the examples I quote, I won't identify the person, says, "How unpatriotic and treasonous of you deceivers of the truth, by both commission and omission, masquerading as superior intellectual snobs when in reality you're nothing but elitist self-serving hate mongers. P.S. Nasty letter to follow." I'm just struck by that kind of level of anguish. And it seems to me that public radio of all media must be a place where there's a kind of civic and civil engagement, where we can talk about the difficulties that we face as a country, but do it in a way that is reasoned.
NPR Ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin, who will be with us here from time to time on Talk of the Nation in the future. Jeffrey, nice to start out a new relationship.
Thank you very much.